podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hi there, I'm Brian Abana, and you're listening to the Mall Over Podcast.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Mall Over Podcast, the only rugby podcast that gives you all the news, views and opinion on the weekend's rugby action, all with 50% of a West Country accent. You can find us on Twitter. We are at Mall Over Podcast and Mall Over Rugby Podcast on Facebook. You may remember a couple of weeks ago, we had a little four ball, little reunion number. But ever since, we've lost the World Cup semi-final. There's been a World Cup final. And one of our rugby brethren appears to have, you know, gone a bit rogue. So this evening, myself and the Lensman are here to have a bit of a chat. And we'll pass you through a roller coaster of rugby emotion. And we'll see where it takes us. Evening, Doug. How are you?
Hello, mate. Hello. This Eddie Stevens cat needs to shut his mouth, doesn't he?
It's funny. I
could have been one too many gym biscuits. Got a bit leery.
I took an inadvertent break from rugby around the banter. I won't lie. in fact, I took a break from rugby podcasts in general, including ours. And I took a listen. I took a listen to Eddie's today. The most surprising thing was he talked about having a job. That shocked me.
Yeah, I'm not buying it.
No,
I'm not buying it.
He's pretended to be a comedian.
Unless his job's standing on corners talking bullshit about red and yellow cards.
Well, let's get into that, shall we? Before we talk about England, and we can do a bit of a World Cup wrap up on England and where they go from here. After we've chatted about the final. But the final started, well, with a card, pretty much, and a miraculous injury recovery magic shit box of a substitution from South Africa.
Yeah. Most of what I'm going to say is going to be directed at our rugby brethren, right?
Right.
Who, across the pond, who's giving it the big one about his wildly all over the map take on the regulation of rugby union and how it affects certain games. And what I'd say is that the start of that World Cup final was it was all sort of set up to be a really great spectacle, and the first 10 minutes were really good. It wasn't even that, was it? It was 2.5 minutes.
It was less than two minutes.
I think I text the group to say there's 2.5 minutes in and we've already got Ben Kay crying about cards need to be given.
I can't understand that card. He fell onto his leg. How many rucks are there in a game where people fall on top of other people? Makes no sense to me.
That is the culmination of, I'd say, 7 or 8 years of social media lunacy, where things that happen that are obvious and clear with detrimental effects to players or the health of players are often refereed and sanctioned more aggressively than really, really dangerous shit that goes on, right?
I was going to say, can we blame Ben Ryan directly for this yellow card?
You can blame Ben Ryan. You can blame that, whatever that fucking neck-bearded prick is in Wales that thinks he's so much special. You can blame any number of
Bubbins?
People that write. Who was it? Was it Peters that wrote about Sam Kane, that was a flagrant and shocking display of?
He basically called it an atrocity. He was one step away from comparing it to things going on in Gaza.
I mean, it's just crazy that a bloke who slightly mistimes a tackle in a game, and we had the same conversation with Phil, and he's not here either. He's a lanky prick, isn't he?
thinks he's Rod Stewart because he's got a hole in his kitchen. Honestly.
talking about how Sam Kane could have controlled that. There was happening like a quarter of a second and Sam Kane's off, but we'll get to that. The first card has been reffed entirely on outcome. That ruck wouldn't have been looked at if Mbanambi hadn't been on the floor rolling around like he'd ruptured like his leg was hanging on by the skin. Nothing would have happened.
Correct.
And then like 3-4 phases later, you've got Eben Etzebeth going into a contact, basically forearm chopping someone in the mush, and nobody bats an eyelid. Now, running into someone, extending your forearm and basically elbowing them in the face is a calculated act that you have to have considered before you do it when you're a ball carrier, right?
Yep.
You have to consider that I'm going to run into this bloke and I'm going to elbow him in the fucking face. And if he gets in the way, unlucky. If you're trying to move someone out of a ruck and you fall on their knee in a slightly bad and it causes an injury, these two things aren't comparable. In the same way that Etzebeth's leading with his elbow, which Eddie thinks is just all right. I mean, I think it's... I personally don't think it's all right. But old Shed Boy thinks that, you know, all he wants to do is be consistent. Well, be consistent, Ed. Like, is it all right to forearm people in the face, but not all right to slightly mistime a tackle? When somebody's running at you, an international standard athlete is running and changing direction, you're meant to be able to consider your body position and manipulate it in a way that isn't dangerous. Had Etzebeth, had the guy who Etzebeth elbowed in the face gone down, clutched his jaw, and the TMO goes back to it, Etzebeth's off. But then
wasn't
Kiwi
that
guy,
Sam Kane as well?
Potentially, but for me, that is a more egregious act than any of the cards that were given. But we've just got ourselves into a position where rugby is completely refereed on outcome because of the optics. And this is what we've been saying for years on this pod. Like, it is more about what is seen to be happening than what is actually happening. Yeah. And in a World Cup final, at the pinnacle of the sport, that is absolutely pathetic. And Russ, it led to me turning the World Cup final off and watching darts.
Wow. Can I mention very quickly, can I comment on why Tom Foley was off to a funeral directly after the World Cup final?
Yeah, yeah. Well, because it was the death of any sanity in rugby. The last shred of sanity in rugby had gone after that. I mean, we're allowing New Zealanders onto a pitch with a fucking spear to do the haka now. I mean, how long is it until they have to, you know, they have a ritual sacrifice of an opposition player because of respect? You know what I mean? It's like, what are we doing here?
I do find it funny. I'd love England. I think I might have said this before. I'd love England to come out and do some kind of Morris dance. You know, or every team has to do some sort of dance
Absolute lunacy of the fact that whoever these guys are waving a spear at and shouting at have got to stand there and take it up the arse dry,
yeah,
without being able to respond is lunacy. The crowd, give me Phil Green getting in someone's face. You know what I mean? I don't understand why they're allowed to do it.
People wipe themselves over the crowd booing it, or like you say, Phil Green and getting right in their face, or people doing the fucking flying V, or you know, all other different.
Let me tell you, if a bunch of Maoris came at Kent and stood on the White Cliffs of Dover going, right, come on, lads, we're going to have a big scrap now. Kent ain't standing there and going, oh, respect them, lads, while they're doing this. No, they're kicking them back into the fucking channel.
Drop kicking them, probably.
Exactly.
With their Reebok Classics on.
No, it's no wonder the Brits went over there and absolutely annihilated them, isn't it?
I mean, there's a lot to be said for colonialism.
They're all there giving it the dance. Like, oh, don't worry, lads, they're not going to shoot us. We're doing our dance.
Oh shit, we've just lost half our troop.
What's happening? Why are they killing us? You're meant to respect us, lads.
the biggest alpha move you could see is if they were doing the Hacker and the Irish just bought on Michael Flatley. Pumping out some river dance. Just 30 seconds of river dance. Right? See how you like it. And no one's allowed to
As long as it's not that fucking Christmas song that the Pogues sang.
That's true. Going back to the World Cup final, though, there was a couple of things that bothered me outside of the cards. I mean, we could talk about the Sam Kane card and
Sia Khaleesi's face. That annoys me.
You can't say that, mate, because some people will deem that as racist, even though it's just a face. A face that came into contact with somebody else's face, but was clearly deemed not equal measure.
Because it's South Africa are having a hard time, so we can't send him off.
Going back to Funeral for a Friend, Tom Foley. Can you explain to me how he managed to go back about six phases to disallow a try for a knock-on?
Because the TMOs aren't regulated. There is no process. There's absolute. This is the insane thing. There was one decision that was made where somebody called a knock-on, and Wayne Barnes obviously had it come through in his earpiece, and he just shouted, "No, no, no," like that, and played on.
Good. I'm all for that.
The problem you've got there is that refereeing crew with Foley, Carl Dixon, who I don't know, like the David Brent of referees.
He must have some pictures of Augustine Pichot.
Oh, but he was a player, so he knows the rules.
Yeah. So was Glenn Jackson, and he was shit referee.
And who was the other bloke on the other touchline?
Wasn't Brace, was it? Brace did England on the touch.
There's another English bloke, weren't it? Carly.
Oh, yeah, Matt Carly.
What are those three blokes all got in common?
Well, they're all shit referees.
They all love a bit of them, don't they?
They've all like got Carl Dixon and
Carly ain't going to stand on those touchlines and be quiet, are they?
No. You know what they've got? They've got what I like to call the Steve Walsh syndrome. Now, Steve Walsh was the original. I'm on the big screen, mate.
Yeah, you can see Foley and Carly and Dixon when there's a decision, they're looking up at the screen every time they're on it. It's madness. I don't know how the game's going to get out of this situation, but there's got to be some kind of formal regulation put in as to what the TMO can and can't get involved in.
Well, I thought because there
Foley was getting involved. Foley was getting involved in fucking knock-ons.
Yeah, he had a suit on, mate. He had a suit on. His mum obviously said, "Look, if you've got your best suit on, Tom, you might get on the telly."
Have you done your hair? Carl Dixon's done his hair. He's got a lovely little side part in now, isn't
fucking he? Guarantee that Carl Dixon's done his hair, probably with Wayne Barnes's spunk. I don't know whether I could say that. I respect Wayne Barnes, so he wouldn't have missed Dixon.
Well, enough. I think he was massively undermined for that whole 80 minutes. He was it was like he couldn't referee the game. It was like he had four blokes who wanted to be centre of attention.
Yeah, and ironically,
a little bit
the best one of the lot was stuck not really doing anything,
doing subs.
Yeah,
yeah. Ironically, it's almost like Barnes's fault for not saying to the TMOs and the ARs, like, I'll make the decisions. If I need you, I'll ask you. But there is no process. There's no process. There's nothing that says the TMO can't intervene in any situation they want to. They can do acts with complete carte blanche. You know, you look at the NFL, and they're only allowed to intervene in certain situations, turnovers, touchdowns.
All scoring plays reviewed.
They're not allowed to get involved in holding calls or the minutiae of the game is left to the referees. And if you've got a situation where you're supposedly having the best available referee in the final, then they should be refereeing it, not some bloke in a suit in a shipping container.
That's correct. And a bloke, a shit bloke in a shit suit in a shit shipping container who isn't good enough to be one of the actual
referees. I'd like to think they'll look back on that in years to come and just go, that was an absolute shambles. We completely over-refereed that game.
100%. Do you see Barnsley's face when he found out that the bunker review, he called Sia and Ardie Severo over, didn't he? Because he took over as captain. He went, and you heard him come through, bunker review, upgraded to red card. And he just went, you just saw his face. Because he knew at that point, he was like, the game was, I mean, the game wasn't fucked as it transpired.
Tom Foley's not the bunker guy, though, is he?
No, he isn't the bunker guy. No, that was out of all of their hands by this faceless, clandestine, cloaked crew, probably sat in Cape Town somewhere, you know, holding people's families.
Direct line of communication to Razzy fucking does what he wants, miss.
He is a fucking wand, isn't he?
It's frustrating because I don't think everyone will laud this South Africa team as being like the best team that was in the tournament, and because they've won it, but they were outplayed by England, they were outplayed by Ireland, they lost to New Zealand in the first game. Is that right?
No, they lost to Ireland, but in fairness,
they lost to Ireland.
But in fairness, they probably would have beaten Ireland if they had someone who could kick. If Pollard had played that game in the group stages, they'd have beaten Ireland.
Yeah, but New Zealand would have won if they'd have lost the final if they had someone who could kick. They'd have lost to England if England had someone who could kick.
Yeah,
they'd have lost to France if France had someone who could kick.
Yeah,
fair. You can't just.
No. I know. I mean, let's be brutal.
I don't think they. I think they were far from the best team. They had the best scrum in the tournament. I don't think they were the best team in the tournament.
Yeah. I mean,
but that's a can of worms, isn't it? Because state of some of their scrums, I just think they're like Kaiser Soze, aren't they? Just convince the world that scrummaging at an angle doesn't exist.
It's we talked at length when we recorded a couple of weeks ago after the quarterfinal, the Ireland New Zealand quarterfinal. Yeah, that's right, isn't it? Ireland New Zealand quarterfinal.
Yeah, because Ireland got knocked out in the quarterfinal.
They did. Yeah, I mean that was probably the biggest smiler for this whole tournament. But I mean, you could put a bet on that. You probably would have got really, really short odds, even though that they were self favourites in their own lunchbox. Ireland going out in the quarterfinals is like death and taxes, right? But Barnsley actually refereed Andrew Porter properly in that match, and as we spoke about with our scrummaging expert Elkins, Oxenche had Carl Sinclair on toast from the minute he came on, or from the minute Sinclair came on. That was evident. But that final scrum, where is it Vincent Cock? Was it Cock? It was Cock, wasn't it? The anger, they talk. You can watch that clip over and over again. Genge gets up off his knee at the set, and all Cock does is turn his ass out and bore in. And it takes ages for O'Keefe to give the penalty. It takes ages. If he saw Genji's knee there at the set, then why not just give the penalty straight away? Or why not give advantage straight away? He doesn't. He waits for it to start moving inside because he then has an excuse. I find it absolutely baffling. I find it baffling that he refereed South Africa in three extremely high profile. And again, I'm not saying in any way is this rigged or biased. I just think he's fucking rubbish.
You shouldn't be refereeing. It would make sense you don't referee two quarterfinal or two games in the knockout series for the
in
same
a row
team.
For the same team. Yeah,
yeah. But that it was interesting that the New Zealand scrum were basically on a parity with the South African scrum for much of that game. A lot of the scrums are very still.
Yeah,
and they look very square. I think I think South Africa obviously took some lessons from that England game and were like, we need to be a bit more careful here.
And because of the way Wayne Barnes
found out,
and the way that Wayne Barnes refereed Andrew Porter.
Yeah.
Because that's obviously exactly what Vince Cock did.
They're obviously looking for that angle. They've found it. They've found Ireland out on it, and their chances are they'll find us out on it.
Yeah.
So.
Well, they won't find us out on anything because our scrummaging is a fucking abomination. The last thing we want is the last thing we want is a scrum. Yet we keep kicking the ball, expecting people to knock it on. It's a great tactic. Yeah. But we sit here at the end of the World Cup with South Africa as champions, which you probably could have predicted pre-tournament. New Zealand arguably playing the best rugby throughout the tournament. And like we've already said, Ireland losing the quarterfinals. So, you know, it's a win. England, the best team in the Northern Hemisphere, which triggered lots of people on the Twitters. Honestly, it's so easy to wind these people up. It's a joke.
Yeah.
Oh, it's absolutely
Central. Well, we're certainly not the best team in the Northern Hemisphere. That is not.
You could argue, you know, third in the World Cup.
You can argue anything, Russ. You could argue Portugal are the best team in Europe.
Depends what your defining criteria is.
Well, exactly. But it is an indisputable fact that you can't argue it.
Well, you probably could. But you would.
I probably would, yeah.
You would argue anything.
Yeah. Arguably, you could say that I would argue that.
Yeah.
I don't think a lot's changed, has it? I think the we're roughly where we were at the end of the 2019 World Cup, except with a lot more butthurt Irishmen. Which I'm all for.
I just, nothing pleases me more. The only way this could have got any better is with a New Zealand victory in that final. If Jordy Barrett slotted that penalty with 5 minutes to go, or whatever it was, and New Zealand had run out winners, it would have been nigh on perfect. Nobody expected England to do anything. We got to a semi-final. That'll do. South Africa lose in the final to New Zealand after giving it massive licks. And as we mentioned, Ireland going to the quarterfinals. That would have been about as.
I mean, I'm very much of the, you probably haven't. Well, I'm very much of the JB script where I wanted England to fail so that there would be a
wholesale change.
Reason to have a long, hard look at ourselves and work out what we're doing wrong and where. The biggest complaint I've got from all this is that. You finish a Rugby World Cup and everyone goes, oh, isn't rugby great? Look how great rugby is. And a Rugby World Cup papers over the cracks in the game.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at the Premiership and rugby outside of the World Cup and it's not in a good place. And you've got bodies that are sort of in opposition to each other. World rugby don't seem to be interested in anything other than sort of world rugby's bank balance. The Premiership were only interested in the Premiership. There's no sort of groupthink about the game. And that's a long-term problem if it gets to being long-term. But I think There are problems that are papered over by this World Cup, and I don't think it will take long for them to emerge again.
What, across world rugby or specifically towards?
Yeah, I just think that, you know, you've got an international game that's only interested in itself. So world rugby is a profit making organisation, right? And they don't have any sort of connection to the club game anywhere, or they've got no interest in sort of helping the club game survive or developing it. They're just interested in, right, what can world rugby do to make world rugby more relevant, which is why we've got this World League coming in, as has been sort of widely sort of documented elsewhere, that is basically being created because World Rugby don't own any of these regional tournaments. So it's like a land grab for World Rugby. What I don't see, I just don't see the benefit to that. In fact, I just see a net loss, because what they'll say is, oh, well, we're developing the game because there's promotion and relegation. But you read between the lines and that's not really the case. And it sort of just weakens the Six Nations because there's more of those games going to be happening because of the way they get this World League structured. So those games become less sort of relevant, which weakens the unions, which means they weaken, they have less, will have less eventually to distribute to the clubs. The clubs will have less to pay players. The players won't have any jobs. There'll be less rugby players. There'll be less clubs. And the cycle will continue.
It's an ever eroding consequence, isn't it? It's almost eating itself.
Yeah, I mean, if you're the Six Nations, all you've got is the Six Nations. I don't know how it's got to this position where the game's just so badly regulated that every single competition, like the Premiership, wants to keep its players away from the internationals because the Premiership, all the players are provided by the Premiership. And they're like, well, why are we weakening our tournament for you to go and make a load of money? Give us our players back. We don't want to release them for all these camps. The RFU are going, well, we need our players because that pays for us to fund the Championship, which is our tournament. So give us your players. But they're also saying, well, we can't afford to fund that because that doesn't make any money. So we're not going to give you any money. But then you've got World Rugby going, well, actually, we run the international game. And I know your union have got the Six Nations and you're part of that and you get the money from that. But we don't really sanction that. So we want you to play in this. Like, but we can't get the players to play in that because the Premiership want them. So it's just madness. You look at, you can say what you like about football, but there's FIFA at the top. Then there's UEFA, CONCACAF and all those regions. And those regions govern the FAs, and the FAs govern the leagues. And it's like a pyramid structure with governance, whereas rugby is just like loads of different dudes going, I want my money.
Swinging dicks left, right, yeah. Centre.
Madness. You know.
The trouble is that can't change, mate, because the people at each level would have to accept the people above them. For it to work, obviously, the structure of football has existed for quite a considerable amount of time. The minute somebody would try to do that
happens,
rugby, so, the greater good of rugby, they would just go, no, because where's my slice of the pie? And they don't get it.
What happens, right? Bill Beaumont's head of World Rugby. He's like, I need to build my part up here. I'm head of World Rugby. But the head of the Six Nations is going, well, I'm head of Six Nations. That's the biggest rugby tournament in the world. So I don't really care about you, Bill Beaumont. And they're like, well, we're playing here and we're going to play it during the Premiership. We don't give a fuck about your world calendar. We don't give any semblance of credence to any argument you may have about a global calendar. The Six Nations is here and we play it here. And then you've got the European Cup that's run by a completely different body, ERC. They have no connection to the Premiership, the RFU, nothing. They're just it's just a competition that's just gone, oh, we'll do that. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's like, it's just madness. It's absolute madness the way it's going.
And it makes it will blow up, definitely.
Yeah.
But I like the way that, you know, we predicted, well, for quite some time, we've been predicting the demise of world rugby and at various levels. There is a ticking time bomb where people will just go, not just supporters, but clubs will go out of business, which they've started doing. So we've lost three Premiership clubs. We're now down to 10 teams.
A quarter of the league.
Yeah. Quarter of the league.
Quarter of the league just gone. And the Premiership, the remaining clubs are so interested in self-preservation that they've gone, meh, we're fine with that.
Yeah, we'll survive. We're doing all right. We'll move on.
Imagine if five clubs in the Premiership football and out of business. Premiership ain't stopping playing games. They're going to promote five clubs immediately. Tomorrow, they'll be in the Premier League.
Yeah, because it's the Premier product. It's what we need to do to survive.
But these nine geezers are like, whatever. More for us.
But then on the flip
the interesting thing will be, Russ, the TV deal's up at the end of this year. Then we'll find out where we are as a sport, because TNT are the only game in town at the moment.
They ain't going to pay more for it.
So,
in fact, I would suggest, mate, that they ain't even going to pay the same for it.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. But the crux of the issue is, Russ, Eddie Stevens talks a load of shit.
Fair. But in his defence, that is one of the most phenomenal Lloyd Grossman impersonations that I have ever heard in my entire life. I'd love him to talk about some sort of tomato ragu sauce.
Yeah. I do hope he takes this in the spirit it's intended. If not, I don't give a fuck. But I would like him to come on whenever we do another podcast and just be Lloyd Grossman for the entire show.
Well, I think there is, you know, without wanting to steal Eddie Sunder, I think apparently he's got a bit of a milestone coming up. So maybe, if he can facilitate an invitation into his shed. After hearing what he gets up to, I would love nothing more than to organise a trip to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and, find a way to spend a few days in Albuquerque, because I can imagine it'll open a few eyes.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen some things and I've been to some places, but Albuquerque, New Mexico strikes me as a place that I would never have seen before.
I'm Vicky Fleetwood and you're listening to the Mall Over Rugby podcast.
So off the back of all that world rugby chat, mate, where do you see England going from here with Tall Eddie, with this Lewis, what's his face, coming from South Africa? What do you see the future holding for England and all the retirees?
I think England will be that they're pretty much going to be in a state of stasis until the old guard goes. And by the old guard, I mean O'Farrell, Elliot Daly, Marler.
Marler's gone, right? Marler's going, right?
Maybe. I just think the time is right for a complete rebuild.
Yeah.
We said it. When did I say it? I think we said it pre-2019. Maybe it was in between. When Eddie was like, we were losing, but we were picking basically the same team that played 2019. It's like, why are we doing this? Like, we could lose by blooding a load of new players.
Yeah.
I think the time is right. I mean, how old is O'Farrell now?
I'm just 32.
32. So he's not, realistically, he's not going to be at the next World Cup, right?
No, because he's not. No, he's not. Because for the last however many years, Ireland have had people can say what they like about Johnny Sexton, right? I don't think he is as good of a player. He's like a system quarterback, right? They've created a system around him because they have had absolutely shit all to take over from him.
Yeah.
So they found a way to play with him. And don't get me wrong, he's been very, very good at it and it's been very effective outside of World Cups. But Ireland have had no tens pushing him. A bit like, Alan Wynne-Jones in the second row for Wales. If they had any decent second rows in Wales, Alan Wynne-Jones would have won 70 caps, not 320.
Yeah.
So I think Farrell playing to the next World Cup.
I think this team has gone as far as it can go with Aaron Farrell. We weren't good enough to win in 2019 when he was a younger, fitter, quicker man. We're not going to be in any better position to win in 27 with a 36-year-old O'Farrell. We've got players like Finn Smith, the young lad at Gloucester. You know, we've got a crop of young tens that can look to do a job going forward, but we need to find out which one of them can stand up and actually do it.
Yeah.
Now's the time to make that change. It won't happen. And I can see us going into the next World Cup with Farrell. I could see us going into the next World Cup with the same debate about Ford Farrell.
With two 36-year-old tens.
Yeah, I could see Manu still being there.
Nah, Manu's done.
How old's he?
I will find
out. I don't think he's much older than Farrell, is he?
No, but I don't think physically he'll get there. I don't think he will. He's 32 as well.
Right. So are we gonna go into the next World Cup with a bunch of 36-year-olds? Or are we going to go into the next World Cup and accept, well, maybe we haven't got a team that is ready to win, but we're looking at further down the road. Now, you know, it's pro sport, so no coach is going to wager their job on building for the future because they might not have a future in the job. So I can see the next 2 or 3 years just being a wasted, futile. Might scrape a Six Nations, you know, wasting a couple of years. Farrell retires in 2 years.
Yeah, picks up a few more unnecessary caps.
Yeah. We've got to find a front row.
Yeah.
We've got to find a front row. And whether or not that means going to South Africa, going to the well in South Africa and getting someone over and qualifying them up and, you know, biting the bullet. But we've just got to find a front row.
Just go and find six absolute behemoths.
Just mutants that you just say, bend over and push your back.
Bloemfontein.
Yeah, I don't care if you can do a behind the back pass. Just bend over and push.
That is all I want you to do.
And eat some fucking pies while you're doing it.
As well as some toast.
Yeah. We can't keep going into rugby matches where our outside centre doesn't touch the ball.
So here's a question. So Ben Eustace, nicest guy in Cornish Rugby Podcasting, made a comment watching the World Cup final, which says, what England need, amongst lots of other things, is a Geordie Barrett centre. A fucking big lump that can actually play rugby.
Well, without wanting to disparage Ben, because he is a lovely bloke, that's a fucking stupid thing to say, isn't it? Right. What England could do with is a world-class 12. You know what? Every team in the world could do with a world-class 12.
I've got half an idea about that, though.
What we could do
Barrett,
world-class players in every position.
Geordie Barrett played quite a lot of rugby at fullback, right?
Yeah.
Played rugby at fullback. Why can't Freddie Stewart play 12?
Why can't Ellis Genge, a bloke who over a number of years has demonstrated he can't bend over and push well enough, but has demonstrated he can run like an absolute mutant into people and inflict grievous bodily harm just by running.
Yeah.
Why can't Ben Earl? Why do we keep forcing these people? Why are all our best athletes put in the pack?
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. I'll tell you, sorry, just going back on something. Did you watch Friday night? Did you watch the bronze medal match?
Sorry, what? Did I watch a bronze medal? No, of course I didn't watch a bronze medal match.
What that match demonstrated, right, from what I watched and having had to drive back from fucking Bedford on a Friday of half term and spend 2.5 hours sat between the Almondsbury Interchange and the Avonmouth Bridge, those who know will be well aware of that, is fucking hell. Sam Underhill, like, I know his head's made of marshmallow and, you know, his injury record is not great. 27 years old, was phenomenal. Probably our best open side.
But he was our best. he was our best flanker in 2019. He was our best player in 2019.
But yet he didn't make the initial squad, flew out there because Willis got injured, and then put in pretty much a man of the match performance in the last.
I don't get it either, mate. I don't get it either.
Makes no sense. Anyway, sorry, I've digressed there a little bit, but
that's what I think to the selection policy.
Yeah. What a real chubby, stubby little finger.
Yeah. It just, I don't know what the answer is, mate. Well, I do know what the answer is. It's get three fucking six massive blokes who can push well.
Yeah.
Better than any of the other six blokes can push. And we need a 10 who's better. We need a 10 who's an out and out 10, not a, you know, what is it Roy Keane said about players who were good in the dressing room?
Tell jokes.
Yeah.
Now,
is that what Aaron Farrell's doing? Is it?
I will argue that
because he's the worst starting fly half for any of the top eight teams. Go through him, Russ. South Africa, Pollard.
Okay, Pollard
or Libok. He's not as good as either of them.
Yeah.
He's not as good as Richard Mwanga. He's certainly not as good as D-Mac.
No.
So there's four. We've only got through two teams. He's not as good as Ntamak.
No, he's probably not as good as
Jalibert. He's probably as good as Sexton. He's not as good as Finn Russell.
He's as good as... But no, so I would argue that I think Finn Russell is criminally overrated.
It depends what you want for 10. I want someone that's going to do stuff at 10, right?
I think
he's going to pump the ball away.
I think you need.
He's like, you know, you remember the Sabutio corner takers? Yeah. Where someone's just stood above him, like pressing his head.
Yeah, with Owen Farrell at 10, you quite literally play 10 man rugby. That's what you do. Because Joe Marchant played, I don't know how many games Joe Marchant played outside Owen Farrell in this World Cup, but I'd like to see his minutes to touch ratio. Through the difference,
you might as well have had John Lawrence playing at 13.
But he had trials of London Irish, mate. So let's not fucking forget that. And let's not forget, like, poor fucking Henry Arundel, right? He plays 60 minutes in the third place playoff match, does not get the ball passed to him by a single England player, right? He makes one catch and kick, albeit a shit kick, then gets hooked for Ollie Lawrence, just so Joe Marchant can go on the wing, and we have three tens on the pitch. But like it was quite clear.
I'd love to know. Like, I'd love to know what they're watching.
It was quite clear in that scenario that this Smith at fullback experiment for the last time it's not worked, right? But actually, Arundel's actually played fullback, and according to London Irish, and you know he's pretty good at it. So let's stick him there. We'll bring Lawrence on. We'll stick Marchant at the wing, but we'll take Smith off. Or we'll take Farrell off because he's done fuck all other than kick goals. Yeah, people will say, oh, yeah, but he was a top point scorer in the whole of the World Cup. And he missed the first two games. But all he did was kick the ball. Didn't do anything else.
I don't know why. Well, I do know why. Money. Is why he's not retiring, because he knows if he wants to be there, he'll play in the next World Cup.
Yeah.
And that's, what is it, 30 grand a game for England?
Yeah. I'll be interested to see who's fucking coached by that time, though. Can't see Tall Eddie still being the coach in 2027, surely. Four more years.
I just want to know what... I would sit down with Aaron Farrell and say, do you think you'll be available for the next World Cup? Are you in a position to say, yes, I will be at the next World Cup? If so, why do you think a World Cup 16 years after your first will be the one where you actually get us over the hump? What do you think you'll do differently to get us over the hump? Because from what I've seen in two World Cups, we've struggled to score points.
Yep.
The last 4 years, we've barely scored a try in proper Test match rugby.
Yep.
And what is the common denominator?
Well,
it's you, Owen.
Yes, it is.
Successive coaches, successive attack coaches, different combinations at centre, different packs. The one thing that's been constant through the last 12 years of England rugby has been Owen Farrell. We've not been good enough to win anything.
No, but we
the
had
odd Six Nations here and there. But in fairness, those Six Nations we had, when we had success in the Six Nations, it was Dylan Hartley that was captain. Yeah. So for all the talk of being this amazing captain, yeah, he's captain at Saracens. He's won a shitload of stuff at Saracens. But they were the Harlem Globetrotters. They won fuck all since that's all been broken up.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, people will make as many as excuses for him as they can. And he has been had his moments of being a good player, but the same shit that we went through with the England football team.
I think
that until you throw away something that hasn't worked for a very long time and stop just expecting it to work, you never know what you've got.
Ford and Farrell, as long-term football fans, Ford and Farrell stinks of Gerrard and Lampard, doesn't it? Always has done.
Gerrard and Lampard keeping Paul Scholes out.
Yeah.
Because what they're doing at the moment...
Or shoehorning Paul Scholes into the left midfield.
Are you telling me that we wouldn't have got to the World Cup semi-final if Marcus Smith had started every game?
No, I'm not saying that. Or not saying
what
that.
What we've done is...
We've spent
4 years stifling the development of one of the most talented players England have produced since 2003.
Yeah, and then ironically gone back to George Ford at the last minute where we probably could have had George Ford all along. Or, because, you know, I think George Ford potentially provides the best balance between Owen Farrell and Marcus Smith.
Yeah.
As a player, I think he provides the kick-in nous and experience versus the maverick sea space, able to create plays. But even George Ford, you can see is and has been stifled through game plan. And the minute you step foot outside of that, you know, you kind of pay the price a little bit. And it's, yeah. We've got so many talented youngsters.
None of them are going to get a shot.
As you've already said, the cutthroat nature of professional sport will mean that no one's willing to.
No one's going to put their
rip it all up and start again.
They're not going to put their job on the line to develop a player that they might not be coaching.
Yeah,
because they want to keep their job.
And the irony
no one's going to really question you if you pick Owen Farrell for the next 2 years.
And the irony of that is I bet you could ask 100 England rugby fans across the country, and 99 of them will say, yeah, I'd support that. I'd support ripping it up and starting again.
Yeah.
Right back to the bare bones.
Yeah.
Go, you know what? We're going to rip it up. We're going to start again. And yeah, we're going to lose. We're probably going to lose quite a lot of matches, but we're going to lose with a plan of development for the next World Cup.
That's just it. I don't think we will lose, because I think if you demonstrate to those young players that you bought in and give them a little bit of backing and actually come up with a way of playing that actually suits those players.
Yeah.
They'll pay you back. I mean, look at Saints. Saints have done exactly this with, and yes, they're not winning competitions, but they're playing amazing rugby. They've given Finn Smith the opportunity to go out there, and they've had one of the best fly halves you could have at Premiership level in Dan Bigger, and they've gone, no, yes, it may be financially motivated, but they've given this lad the team and said, it's yours.
Can I suggest...
What should have done with Marcus Smith? Because all that Marcus Smith has had for the last 4 years is doubt.
Yeah, and Owen Farrell with the sword of Damocles hanging over his head, or Owen Farrell playing outside him at 12.
I've got to play out of my skin, or they're going to hook me and put Owen Farrell
can
back
I,
in.
Can I suggest that France, if you look at France, all they have done, this is exactly what they've done. They have they basically ripped it up and started again.
They had that douche to our team after 2015, and they just went, we're going to have a little bit of a struggle, and we're going to...
And they located...
We're going to find players with it.
And it made a lot of difference because they located players and they discovered and they gave people a go. So they had like the back row of Aldrete and, my mind's gone blank now, but why can't I think of the six and the seven? Fuck's sake. Mine's gone blank. But in behind that, they discovered the likes of Jelonch and others. But they had Untermack and Dupont and Jalibert and Ramos and Villiers and the guy that played... Villiers didn't even play in the World Cup. And, Penno, right? And they basically just went... The only guy that survived out of that 2015 World Cup squad, I think, was probably Fiku, wasn't it? Like, in the backs. Fiku stuck around for a little while. But Fiku evolved his game to be much better. And having those youngsters around him, Fiku turned into a world-class centre.
Danny
he went
Kerr
from being average to
Danny
being
Kerr's not world-class scrum half, and he's played in his fifth World Cup.
Yeah.
Is it five?
Four.
Yeah, he didn't go to 2019, did he? So it could have been five World Cups. I'm not having he's in the top five scrum halves in England. The fear of trying something different is stifling this England team.
But that's the RFU way, isn't it? That's all like the suits and the Bill Sweeneys of this fucking world. It's just the old man way. And unfortunately, until the next generation are able to take over through whatever means, It's a long way away, and English rugby might well be dead by then anyway. So
we can hope. Should we do some AOB and
let's have a chat about something else and get the shit out of here.
Go on, you go first.
Well, no, you go first. You were going to ask me a question. You were going to ask me a question, weren't you?
Well, I was going to ask you how you feel about Tottenham. It's the hope that kills you, isn't it?
Always, right?
That's what me and one of the rugby brethren were saying at our dinner.
But as
in the semi-final.
But as a Tottenham fan, right, I haven't... All of the hope has been beaten out of me for quite a considerable... Well, all my life, given the fact that we've won two trophies in the 41 years that I've been... Well, no, that's wrong. In the 41 years I've been on the planet, we've won four or five trophies. Since I've been supporting them since 1991, and it was the cup final, the Gazza Cup final 91, Lineker penalty, Nottingham Forest. That was when my Tottenham allegiance first started. Call me a glory hunter if you wish, but that's where I am. And you know what? Like, it's not about the success. What I like more than anything, and you talk about coaches, and you talk about honesty, and you talk about, you know, You never know what goes on behind closed doors with these people. But I've watched countless now press conferences with this Postecoglou. And I can't say I was particularly a fan of his when we appointed him. Didn't know much about him. Knew he did well with Celtic. But I reckon I could manage Celtic to a Scottish Premier League title. So, you know, it didn't come with a glowing reference. But the more I hear from him, the more I see him talk, I've watched him clips at fans forums, I've watched clips at interviews, and he seems to have this ethos of, well, if you work hard and you have the right attitude and you try to win football matches, logic would dictate you will come out on the right, and you've got good enough players, you will come out on the better side of results more often than not. And I'm a firm believer in any sport, you've got to go out there to win. And a bit like England rugby, right? Antonio Conte, Jose Mourinho style of football is, well, first of all, we're not going to lose. So let's go out there with we're not going to lose mentality. And then we'll see whether we can nick it. Whereas, actually, my thought on sport is, well, if you're not going to try and win, what's the fucking point? You have to try and win. To win rugby matches or to win football matches, you've got to score goals. Yes, there are different ways to score points at rugby, but you get the maximum amount of points to score in a try, right? It's all very well getting down into the 22 and kicking goals and getting 3 points, brilliant. But if the other team are getting the ball and going up the other end and scoring 5 points every time, you're not going to win. So when it comes to football, if you're playing attacking progressive football, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to leave yourself vulnerable at the back all the time. It just means when you get the ball, you're looking to go forward and do something with it. The amount of times over the last 3 years I've watched Tottenham and they've just gone what I like to call the David Batty approach, which is sideways and backwards. If you want, for those of you that remember David Batty as a footballer, David Batty is sideways and backwards.
It's how United won God knows how many trophies. They can see teams and they tried to win.
Progressive.
It's how Arsenal are playing. It's how Man City play. It's how Spurs are playing. Yep. It's not how United are playing at the moment.
Nope.
Much to my sugar. But I think it's good. I'd love Tottenham to win the league if it's not United, just because it'd be funny if they won it before Arsenal.
It would be absolutely delicious. But I'm under no illusions that being,
you're definitely going to fuck it up.
We will lose a game, and the interesting thing will be the reaction after when we lose, and the reaction as to say, right, what happens now, and keeping on with that, the biggest test for any coach, the biggest test for any team is, can you keep your same ethos when things aren't going your way? And they've had a lot of things go their way, right? And there's make no bones about that. The Liverpool thing and, different bits and pieces that have gone their way. But they've also had a bit of shit. How do you bounce back from adversity? If you can stand by your principles and be confident in that when it's all crashing down around your ears, that'll be the mark of a team. They're still light as a squad. Which will hopefully be addressed, over the coming months. But other than that, it's just nice to see watch your team and be excited. But it's nice to watch your team and be excited about watching them play, because I'd given up on that. I couldn't even watch them. Couldn't even watch it because it was just so dire.
I in any sport, I'd rather lose trying to win, than lose try not to lose.
it makes no sense. Yeah, of course it does, because if you're not trying to win, right, and if your whole game plan is, oh well, we're going to sit really deep and we're going to soak it all up and then try and hit you on the break. If you haven't got the players that are good enough to soak that up, then you're just going to concede goals and lose, which is what has happened to Tottenham for the last 3 years. When Mourinho took over and did that at Chelsea, everyone thinks, oh, Mourinho had this brilliant attacking free-flowing football. He didn't. He played exactly the same football. He just had much better players. And he tried to do the same at United. He did. And he had, when he did it at Chelsea, he had the likes of John Terry. He had Petr Cech. He had Paulo Ferreira. He had Ricardo Carvalho. He got Drogba. He had, even the likes of Ødegaard Johnson and these people he picked up. He played like Claude Makélélé just broke things up. He was the original guy at doing that.
He went from Makélélé to Ballack to
John Obi Mikel.
Yeah,
but you've got to win. You've got to try and win matches, right? And if your ethos is win by trying not to lose, then I just think it's fundamentally flawed. Unless you've got the best players.
Yeah. So. I've got two quick things. I'll let you go. Have you watched the Jimmy Savile documentary? The Jimmy Savile drama with
Alan
Partridge in it yet?
No, I've heard it's really good, but I didn't.
It's very, very good. I'd highly recommend it. Just a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Not for the victims.
I mean, they're already dead.
The last thing I'm going to leave you on this one is I've my cricket club here. I'm social secretary now, but I'm also one of the match day captains. Ooh. I've got a group of like three or four guys it's three that are going to captain on match days because none of us can make all of the games. So in honor of this momentous occasion, I've decided to order myself a baggy cap in my team's colours, but from the same people that make the Australian baggy caps.
Right.
I'm not going to tell you how much they are because Mark 2 sat around the corner, but they're pretty punchy, and it's going to take them 56 days to make it.
Well, I would, I'd hope so. At least
they're like handmade. I don't know. Sorry?
At least they're making it bespoke. It's not just...
Yeah. And it comes in like a velvet bag.
Oh, mate, I fucking wear the velvet
bag. Might be the most gauche thing I've ever purchased in my life.
Can we resolve? I know we went with the MOI.
Hey, if you can get up here for a game...
I'd love to have a game of cricket for whoever it is that you play for.
The Little Miss and the Misfits.
The Little Miss and Misfits on a Sunday afternoon or whenever. Is it a Sunday afternoon village green type of affair?
Yeah.
I would love to come and have a little knock on a Sunday. And we'll definitely...
Golf in the morning, cricket in the afternoon. We still do teas. It's great.
Love a tea.
Yeah. Love a tea. Mate, the captain's chairman match last year, there was a full roast beef joint and a full salmon, like poached salmon.
I mean, I'll pass on the salmon.
Homemade scones, the lot. It was unreal. It's unreal.
That is amazing. I can only imagine what Lloyd Grosso would make of it all.
Yeah.
Anyway, mate, it was a lot of fun. Great to catch up. And,
definitely.
Maybe we should just do a ever so often
two-hander.
Two-hander, chat about shit.
Maybe we don't even talk about rugby, mate. We've spoken about that for a long time.
Yeah, we'll see. Maybe we will. Maybe we'll just...
I'm fucked if I'm watching any Premiership rugby that I'm not working on.
Mate, I am no longer employed by the people that did or did not make that particular channel. I don't pay for it, so I'm out.
Right.
Anyway, go well.
Bye, mate.
Speak soon.
Nice one. Cheers, bud.
Sports Social Podcast Network. Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.